This is Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Rank and File Radio is a weekly program covering labor issues from national and international perspectives. We are your hosts, Doug Nesbitt
and Andrew Stevens. Today we interview David Campfield, a professor of labor studies at the University of Manitoba and author of Canadian Labor in Crisis, Reinventing the Workers' Movement. We also speak with Crystal Mackey, a member of PSAC Local 901 at Queen's University, about the upcoming April 21st Ontario Federation of Labor Day of Action.
But first, here's this week's labor news update.
Labor relations at Air Canada continue to deteriorate, as the Canada Industrial Relations Board has ruled that the high volume of sick calls made by the Air Canada pilots amounts to an illegal job action. Over 150 pilots called in sick on a single day. Reports suggest that this action is a protest against the federal back-to-work legislation introduced by the Conservative government in March. The CIRB ordered the work stoppage to end. Air Canada claims that the disruptions forced the airline to cancel approximately 75 flights. Those pilots involved in the work stoppage could face fines of up to $1,000 a day. As the company's press release states, quote, the Canada Industrial Relations Board granted, at Air Canada's request, an order declaring that certain pilots were participating in an illegal strike, ordering ACPA, the pilots' union, to take all reasonable steps to bring an end to the illegal strike, and requiring all pilots participating in the illegal strike to immediately return to work and perform their duties in the normal manner. The Air Canada Pilots Association, which represents the company's 3,000 pilots, said that the union did not initiate or sanction the job action and urged members to report to work. The union's right to strike has been suspended by the back-to-work legislation known as the Protecting Air Services Act. The union is caught in a difficult situation. The Act requires the Pilots Association to take reasonable steps to ensure that its members comply with the provisions of the legislation. Union officials each face fines of up to $50,000 a day if they do not enforce the ban on strike action. At the same time, Captain Paul Strachan, ACPA's president, has criticized the government for handing Air Canada, quote, an insurance policy against industrial action. Despite paying lip service to protecting consumers, travelers, and the Canadian economy, Lisa Raitt, the federal minister of labor, has poisoned labor relations at Air Canada. Wildcat strikes by Air Canada maintenance workers and the recent allegations of job action by the pilots are indications that labor relations have broken down.
In 2011, Winnipeg public transit drivers reported 63 incidents of violent assault, an increase of over 300% compared to figures from 2005. These findings were presented by Jim Gurdon, president of Local 1505 of the Amalgamated Transit Union, and David Sauer, president of the Winnipeg Labor Council, to the City's Standing Committee on Infrastructure Renewal and Public Works on April 12th. A common theme among the assaults is passengers contesting fares, either not paying the correct amount or trying to get on the bus for free. In response to the rise in assaults against transit drivers, BCMP Peter Julian tabled a private member's bill in February that seeks harsher penalties for those who attack transit workers. If passed, Bill C-402 would see the maximum possible sentence increased to 20 years under the Criminal Code. Local 1505 represents about 900 drivers at Winnipeg Transit and 29 bus operators at Brandon Transit. The Amalgamated Transit Union has over 180,000 members in both Canada and the United States.
According to the results of an Environix research survey conducted for the Broadband Institute, Canadians are not opposed to tax increases if the revenues are used to preserve social programs like health and education. The research institute was founded by former NDP leader Ed Broadbent. Despite the refusal of both federal and provincial governments to have a serious discussion about increasing revenues through tax increases, the Institute's report concludes that, quote, any government or political party that prioritizes the tackling of income inequality will not only reflect current public opinion, they will garner Canadian support because they will finally be addressing an issue that represents a fundamental Canadian value, equality, end quote. Of the 2,000 Canadians included in the survey, 71% said the widening gap between the rich and poor undermines Canadian values. Reports on income distribution over the last 5 years indicate that fewer and fewer Canadian households possess an increasingly disproportionate share of the country's wealth. This income gap has worsened since the 2008 financial collapse. 83% of those surveys support higher taxes for the richest Canadians, and 73% want corporations to pay more taxes. Based on political affiliation, 58% of Conservatives said that they are willing to pay more to protect social programs compared to 71% of NDP members and 72% of Liberal Party members. These numbers suggest that the desire to maintain quality public programs through a redistributive tax system transcends political affiliations. The full report can be found online at www.broadbentinstitute.ca.
Despite the passage of Bill 22, the BC Teachers Federation vows a comeback. Following a legal three-day strike in March, after 7 months of work to rule, the provincial Liberal government passed Bill 22, effectively banning job action by teachers for 6 months. Fines range up to $20 million a day if this ban is broken. The bill has many features, including the option of unilaterally imposing legislation with regards to unresolved bargaining issues. BC teachers are also confronted with a government-appointed mediator who was actually involved in crafting the back-to-work legislation last month. Teachers, however, have won widespread public sympathy and support. Much of this comes with the efforts of teachers to negotiate smaller class sizes. A large number of concessions remain on the table from a provincial government seeking what it calls a net-zero contract, in which all labor costs are frozen. For example, net-zero would mean that an increase in wages would result in cuts to labor costs elsewhere, such as benefits. The membership of the BCTF will be voting this coming week on an action plan for how to confront an increasingly unpopular government committed to austerity in the education sector.
We're joined today by Crystal Mackey, a member of Public Service Alliance of Canada Local 901. PSAC 901 represents graduate teaching assistants and teaching fellows at Queen's University in Kingston. Crystal is the previous Vice President Community Affairs for Local 901 here at Queen's. Crystal, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Tell our listeners about the Ontario Federation of Labour Day of Action and why this event is being organized.
Well, the OFL Day of Action has been organized primarily around the cuts to public services. So Premier Dalton McGuinty put Don Drummond in charge of recommending nearly 400 cuts to jobs and public services in Ontario. This includes everything from healthcare to all-day kindergarten and, of course, pensions. At the same time that public works are cut and the social safety net is eroded, corporations are still getting the tax breaks, and public works and services seem to be being put under pressure to balance the budget. And basically, the OFL is saying that, you know, he can't cut his way to economic prosperity. And so a day of action has been organized, including different community groups, students, labor. Basically, everyone's invited to the mass rally.
Is it a province-wide day of action, or is this located mostly in Toronto and other cities in Ontario?
From what I gather, it's primarily being organized out of Toronto. And PSAC Ontario has organized buses from all different cities to head to Toronto. And the bus that we're going to be sending is actually going to be stopping at the Toronto regional office, where there's a free lunch provided for people who've taken the bus with us. And then a brief teach-in will happen where we learn about some of the issues and learn some of the different chants we'll be doing. And then we'll head down to the rally at 3 p.m.
You mentioned that community groups, community members, and really anyone in Ontario is invited to take part in this day of action. Is everyone welcome on the PSAC 901 bus to Toronto?
Absolutely. The bus will be leaving at 9 a.m. outside of Stauffer Library. And as long as you RSVP at psac.getonthebus@gmail.com and save your spot, you can totally come with us. Public cuts affect everybody, students, retirees, public workers, obviously. So it compromises all of our lives. So everybody's welcome to join us on the day of action.
Great. Thank you, Crystal.
Thanks.
Again, the bus to the Day of Action will pick up passengers at Stauffer Library on Queen's University campus at 9 a.m. sharp on Saturday, April 21st. That's the corner of Union and University Avenue. There will be a free lunch at the PSAC Toronto Regional Office at noon. More information can be found on the PSAC 901 website, www.psac901.org. You are listening to Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM. Stay tuned after these messages for our interview with David Camfield.
K Keep your thumb on the pulse of global issues. Tune into Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, heard right here on CFRC 101.9 FM on weekdays from noon to 1 p.m. and rebroadcast again weekdays at 7 a.m. Democracy Now! Provides their audience with access to people and perspectives rarely heard in the U.S. corporate-sponsored media. Tune in or check them out online at democracynow.org.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Studies in National and International Development, or SNID, hosts the only interdisciplinary seminar at Queen's where students, faculty, staff, and community come together weekly to discuss global and local issues, such as the politics of science, technology, and the environment, human rights and the war on terrorism, the global politics of breast cancer and medical research, Canada's involvement in Afghanistan, and the Chavez Revolution in Latin America. Join us every Thursday from 1 until 2:30 p.m. at Matt Corey, B204. And check out our website at www.queensu.ca/snid to learn more about upcoming events.
Fine! Take my $1.50! Take it all!
Whoa, why are you paying fees?
My credit union only has a few ATMs, so I pay!
Check the back of your debit card for the exchange logo. Your credit union has more than 2,300 ATMs.
That's right, folks. The exchange is your ticket to no-fee withdrawals, deposits, PIN changes, and more at over 2,300 ATMs across Canada. Check the back, Jack. Get the ATM locator app at keepyourchange.ca. Keep your change. Use the exchange.
Welcome back to Rank and File Radio. Today you're going to be listening to our interview with David Camfield, who teaches labor studies at the University of Manitoba and recently authored Canadian Labor in Crisis, Reinventing the Workers' Movement, that was published by Fernwood Press last year. We're going to ask him a few questions about the current state of the labor movement in relation to the analysis that he provided in his book. Hi, David.
Hi.
So our first question, your book has two major parts. The first part is an analysis, a bit of history, and a critique of the labor movement as it exists now, where it came from, why it's in the situation it is now in terms of falling union density and kind of a lack of militancy and ability to fight back against austerity measures. And then the second half of the book is really looking forward to how to reinvent the labor movement. So with those two general approaches in mind in your book, I was wondering, since the election of the Tories, or really since the publication of your book, which is roughly the same time, I was wondering what you've seen in the labor movement and among workers in general in terms of reinventing the labor movement, what sort of positive aspects you've seen that tie into what you propose.
Well, in my book, I have a section that I call Seeds of Hope, where I try to identify various kinds of examples where workers, whether unionized workers or workers acting other ways, have been engaged in actions which might maybe prefigure or give us a sense of a different kind of movement. And these are, unfortunately, are not so many these days. They're not so many. And also, it's difficult to chart them because there are really very few publications that try to actually identify and publicize the existence of these kinds of collective actions. So I think there are some examples we can look to that are inspiring. One that's very fresh on my mind at the moment is at Air Canada, where workers at Air Canada have really been through the ringer in the last decade, having given major concessions when the company was under bankruptcy protection, and now facing an employer that has been demanding to give up more. And so we saw recently a situation where the federal labor minister, Lisa Raitt, was passing through Pearson Airport, and a couple of baggage handlers slow-clapped in response to seeing her because the government had passed legislation which prevented them from exercising the right to strike. In fact, they had used this obscure part of the Canada Labor Code to send the set of negotiations to an investigation, which would mean that they suspended their right to strike, and then they brought it back to work legislation against them before they'd struck. And so in response to this act of mocking the minister, these workers were disciplined immediately, and this then led to workers walking off the job both at Pearson and at several other airports. And I think it was an example of direct action, which had a real impact on the company and really, for those who had eyes to see, highlighted the problems that workers are facing at Air Canada. And so I think it was a hopeful sign there for workers to take unofficial action during the term of their collective agreement. This has become very rare in recent years. The number of mid-term contract strikes has fallen to single-digit numbers in the last couple of years, historical lows. So that's one example. Another example would be also at Air Canada, the way the pilots have been responding, the way they've been treated, again, having their right to strike effectively taken away through back-to-work legislation. There, what's interesting is there have been what appears to be forms of unofficial action where pilots have been calling in sick and thereby disrupting the operations of the company. And what's interesting about the most recent events, which took place at the end of last week, is that it seems that there's a group called 97 Squared, it's an unofficial organization of pro-union pilots at Air Canada, who, feeling that their official leaders have been handcuffed by the government and by its legislation, they have decided to organize themselves independently, issuing a statement saying, "Our only way forward is via the grassroots movement, and that is what we represent." And recognizing that they have a lot of power as pilots, as they say, without us, there is no Air Canada, there are no departures, and there's no revenue. If we stand united, protect each other, there's no danger to our pension, to our scope, to our profession. Long after this faction of corporate raiders have left with their millions, we will still be here, as we have for the past 75 years. But the question is, what will be left? That's for us to decide. We must take it upon ourselves to fight back. And so this is interesting because it's very rare these days for workers, pro-union workers, to organize unofficially, as independent of the official union structures, to take action that can use channels which are not open to the union officially, or if the union officially were to do it, then there'd be very, very significant fines or other legal repercussions. So those are a couple of examples. And I'll just also mention one other, which is that in Toronto, where the municipal public sector workers have been up against Rob Ford's administration, a very aggressive right-wing government at Toronto City Hall, and they've been having a lot of difficulties with cuts to jobs and cuts to services that have been brought in. But there has been a significant fight back against this in Toronto. It's not on the scale that's really necessary, but it's a lot better than what we've seen in some other places, where community neighborhood-based anti-cuts groups have formed and have had some success in actually pushing back, at least net for now, a whole number of the cuts that the Ford administration was trying to bring in. There still are cuts, but they're not on the same scale that the Ford administration was wanting to bring in. And so that kind of organization of pro-union anti-cuts activists working in the community, mobilizing around issues that affect working people, I think that needs to be seen as part of the working class movement. Also, I guess on a limited scale, we could say in Toronto, there's been the recent strike by library workers, Toronto Public Library workers, mm-hmm. who managed to do certainly better than I think recent strikes in the municipal public sector in Toronto have done. They did end up having to give a significant concession, but they also made some gains in terms of converting part-time jobs into full-time jobs for library workers, for a certain number of workers, and also for improving the benefit package for part-time workers. And those are gains that are very rare to win these days. One last example, very quickly, is from Brock University, where a very small group of workers, 38 people who teach English as an additional language, went on strike after the employer, in a very bizarre move, they successfully negotiated a collective agreement, and then they ratified it, and then the top echelons of the university administration refused to accept the deal that had been actually negotiated by their own bargaining team, and so a strike broke out. And what was interesting there is that this small group of workers had a lot of support, something like 30% of the faculty at Brock refused to cross their picket lines, and large numbers of the contract faculty or sessional instructors, who, like the ESL teachers or members of CUPE, also refused to cross their lines. And so they actually won pretty clear-cut victory against Brock University. And, this solidarity was, on a much higher level than we usually see in strikes on university campuses. It was critically enabled by the fact that the faculty union collective agreement has language that protects faculty from being forced to cross picket lines that they don't want to cross. And there's similar, although not quite as strong, language in the contract for the contract faculty. That kind of solidarity between different groups of workers who all work for the same employer, I think, is is rare these days and quite significant.
When it comes to organized labor, the elected leadership, and kind of organized labor's bureaucracy, that whole administration, you're pretty critical of how it operates and how it places certain limits on wide variety of aspects of workers' abilities to fight back. Have you seen any of, in the last year, any of your critiques confirmed, or have you had to modify what you see? Or maybe if you can comment on that.
Well, I guess I would love to say that I've been proven wrong, because if I was wrong about this, we'd be in a better situation. But I think that events have unfortunately confirmed the analysis, and number of examples one could give. There have been a number of situations where widespread solidarity action, not just words but real action, would have been very important in helping groups of workers, and this kind of action was not forthcoming. So, for example, if we start on the West Coast and look at the BC Teachers Federation, who faced an absolutely reactionary piece of legislation which removes their ability to negotiate around the size and composition of classes. Composition refers to the number of special needs students in each class. So imposing through this piece of legislation, Bill 22, pieces of previous law that had been struck down by the BC Supreme Court. So the BC Teachers Federation was quite mobilized, but facing off against the provincial government more or less by itself. And while there were various words of solidarity from the BC Federation of Labor Leadership and from the leaders of various affiliate unions within BC, there wasn't any action forthcoming, which really boxed in the teachers in terms of what they could do. And it was very similar in the summer of 2011 when the Canadian Union of Postal Workers went on a series of rotating strikes that was then turned into a lockout by Canada Post Corporation. There was verbal support, and people went to some rallies and so on, but there wasn't the kind of meaningful solidarity action that would have actually made a difference in the outcome of that dispute. One or two labor councils in the Maritimes passed resolutions calling the Canadian Labor Congress to call a day of action to support the postal workers, but that was about it. That was I think quite concerning. And then we saw at Electromotive Diesel, where Canadian auto workers there in London, Ontario, at that plant owned by the multinational Caterpillar, found themselves locked out. And despite a significant day of action, public protest, and some other forms of solidarity that were happening, there wasn't the kind of mobilization, strategic mobilization, strategic militancy that would have been necessary to actually give those workers a fighting chance of winning. And I think it's been recently pinpointed in an article written by Herman Rosenfeld and published in the e-newsletter, The Bullet, where he argues that the leadership of the CAW essentially accepted that there was going to be a closing. And the fight was really about the getting a decent package, severance package and so on. The terms of the defeat would be what they were really going to negotiate. They weren't actually fighting to win. And then, just to take another example, at Air Canada, we've seen the federal government intervene now on several occasions to suspend the right to strike or walk out of workers at Air Canada when they were in a legal strike situation, using this completely disingenuous appeal to a provision of the Canada Labour Code, which claims that there could be a threat to people's safety, health and safety. And then by suspending the right to strike while that investigation is underway, supposedly that has given the government time to prepare the back-to-work legislation and to ram that through Parliament, to send the unresolved issues to arbitration, and then the legislation waits the outcome of the arbitration in the favor of the employer. And so it happens to flight attendants, it's happened to mechanics and baggage handlers, it's happened to pilots, and that was an outrageous attack on the right to free collective bargaining, and the absence of action has been really startling. Maybe the worst case was the flight attendants, who are QP members, who democratically voted down two tentative agreements negotiated by their bargaining team, and then were poised to strike when their legislation was brought in against them. And, you know, despite words of protest about the violation of collective bargaining rights that are involved in this, there was no action taken. And, you know, there were also, you know, in all these situations, groups of workers who were prepared to try to defend themselves in a time when so many workers are under attack were not given the kind of support that was necessary by the official leadership of the labor movement. So those are some examples that stand out in my mind.
That's all the time we have this week. Join us again next Wednesday, 5:30 to 6 p.m., for the conclusion of our discussion with David Camfield, when we talk about the role of the state, trade unionism, and politics on CFRC 101.9 FM. Stay tuned.
But there was a time that I thought how I thought I was still able to try to carry on. It's been a long time coming, but I know the change gotta go. It's been so long,